Hope everyone is doing well. Welcome back. All right. Does anyone have any questions while we're waiting to start in regards to finding any of the information online or anything like that? Anything about the FPMT, certificate of achievement or anything like that? Any questions? Feel free to unmute and ask if you do. And of course, throughout the program or the class, feel free to type questions into the chat box. And we do try to get to those through class. And for those of you streaming on YouTube, you can also use the chat feature in YouTube as well. Okay, we've got a few more folks joining us, and then I think we'll get started. Hey, Beth. Nice seeing some familiar faces from last cycle. No questions. Wow. You guys are awesome. If you do find that you have questions, remember my email address was in that main document that's posted online, or you can ask me before or after class, or you can ask in the chat box even. All right. So, Robbie, if you're ready,
Okay. You've let everyone in.
Yep. And okay. We may have others joining us, but I'll continue to let folks in.
Okay. Thank you, Linda. And good evening, everyone. Welcome to our second of six classes in the Discovering Buddhism Model Mind and Its Potential. Tonight we're going to begin with some meditation, and we'll also start going very briefly through the traditional prayers that we say at Kadampa Center. A lot of people may be familiar with them, and this will be old hat, but I'm going to go from the point of view that everyone's fairly new. So we'll go through one of the prayers each week, and then that'll take us through the traditional ones. And as Buddhism is a non-theistic philosophy or religion, people frequently ask, who are we praying to when we say these prayers? And people have asked Geshe Gelug that question many times, and his answer is always that these are aspirations. These are prayers that we recite because they're things we aspire to, and they make a positive imprint on our mind stream that can bring them to reality if we are sincere in our practice. So Linda, if you can bring up Refuge in Bodhicitta for us, please. Okay. Yeah. Taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. This is the first prayer we say, and it's traditionally always recited three times, whether you're reciting it in English or in Tibetan or any other language that you find appropriate. Refuge and bodhicitta are both modules down the line in Discovering Buddhism. There's a module on each of those. Taking refuge means turning to the Buddha, the historical Buddha, the Dharma, the teachings of the Dharma, and the Sangha, those who are following his path. So acknowledging that that is our source of strength, our source of refuge. So it's said that we take refuge by acknowledging the strength of those three, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, frequently also referred to as the three jewels. And then generating bodhicitta, which we talked a little bit about last week, is the mind or the aspiration to become enlightened for the benefit of others. So it has two aspects, wanting to become enlightened, which means developing our innate qualities of wisdom and compassion to their highest potential, not just for ourselves, though it certainly benefits ourselves, but so that we can be of greater benefit to others. So this prayer brings those two thoughts to mind, taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. So we say, I go for refuge until I am enlightened. And that's interesting. It's saying that we will become enlightened. We will, each of us, become a Buddha. And once we become enlightened, we don't need to go for refuge anymore. Okay? That quality is perfected. It's part of the path that gets us there. But when we become a Buddha, we don't, no longer need to go to refuge. To the Buddha, the historical figure who lived 2,500 years ago, who was just an ordinary human being like us, the Dharma, which is his teachings that have been passed down to us in various forms, and the Supreme Assembly or the Sangha, which refers to others on this path. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create, which means the positive energy or the good karma, the positive imprints I create through listening to the Dharma, that means listening to the teachings, studying them, contemplating them, meditating on them, may I become a Buddha, so that we create the causes, the merits that cause our own enlightenment. May I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So the first two lines are refuge. The second two lines are bodhicitta. Okay? So to begin our meditation, we'll read this together three times. If everybody can stay on mute and I'll read it, but you can read along with me. And we typically place our hands together at our heart. So that's a pot, creates some sort of positive energy in our body. And it may just seem like a lot of words, but even just repeating them is said to be beneficial. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So it says that saying these prayers before we begin our meditation is like tilling the soil where we plant our seeds. If we just cast them on the hard ground, they're not necessarily going to grow and flourish. But these prayers help prepare our mind for the meditation that's to follow. And we'll go through the rest of the preliminary prayers over the next few weeks. So we'll just start with that one. And now we'll begin our meditation session. So start by checking your posture. If you're sitting in a chair, as I imagine most of you are, sit towards the front of your chair so you're not leaning back. Your feet are flat on the floor. If you want to put a cushion under your feet, that's fine. Your back is a little bit straighter than you normally sit. Not rigid, but a little bit, it's said to be a regal, king-like posture. Head may be just a couple degrees in front of the vertical, but not tilted to one side or the other. Eyes either lightly closed or just very slightly open, so a little bit of light comes in. Lips slightly closed with the tongue on the palate above our upper teeth. Shoulders down and a little bit back so our chest is open. Arms away from our torso so a little bit of air moves in through there. And our hands in our lap, touching with our thumbs touching, right hand on top of the left, the union of wisdom and compassion that is enlightenment. As I said, if you're in a chair, your feet are flat on the floor. If you are sitting on a cushion, then your legs can be crossed in any position that you find comfortable and stable. So take a moment, scan your body, starting at the top of your head, moving down. Identify any sites of tension or discomfort so you can address those now and they won't be a distraction during the meditation. And having established our posture, we now take three deep breaths, the stomach expanding on the in-breath and contracting towards our back on the out-breath three times. And now we allow our breathing to return to its normal pattern. And again, we reflect on our motivation, our reason for doing this meditation, with the understanding that any motivation is fine, but it said the most beneficial, the most powerful one, is the bodhicitta motivation we mentioned earlier, that even doing something as simple as this meditation is done with the intention of developing my mind so that I can be of benefit to others. So think along those lines for just a moment. And now we begin the actual meditation, the simple concentration meditation that we did last week. The mind, the awareness, the consciousness, we all use all three of those terms somewhat interchangeably, is on the physical sensation of the breath moving in and out through our nostrils. Direct perception. Not visualizing it, not imagining it, but directly experiencing the slightly cool movement of the breath in and out through our nostrils. Nothing more, nothing less than that. And every time we notice our mind has wandered off to another object, we gently set that aside and come back to the breath. Like leading a child who has wandered off the path back by the hand. No judgment, no harshness, just very patient understanding that that's the nature of our mind to wander off right now. And we're training it in something different. So that'll be the meditation we do for the next 5 minutes or so. And now we can end this meditation session with a dedication. We can acknowledge that we've done something a little bit out of the ordinary that has made a positive imprint on our mental continuum. And we can think, may that positive energy not be lost, but may it ripen in the future in a way that benefits all living beings. And you can relax your concentration. Okay, let me just pull up my gallery view and see what I see. Okay, great. Good seeing everyone again. This module is entitled Mind and Its Potential. So the first thing is to become very clear about what we're talking about when we talk about the mind. We can't talk about its potential if we don't know what we're talking about. And as I said last week, everything in Buddhism is about developing our mind, developing our positive qualities of compassion, the wish that others be free of suffering, and of wisdom, which is an understanding of reality. And those are the two characteristics of the fully enlightened mind, or the mind of a Buddha, completely compassionate and completely wise. And that's a potential that exists within each of us. And it's not done through physical activity, but it's done through mental activity. And if we've really developed bodhicitta, the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of others, it's based on an understanding that the best thing we can do for others is to get our own act together. Okay? Not that we shouldn't be generous and serving physically in this lifetime, but the most valuable gift we can give to others is developing our mind. And that's the fundamental approach of Buddhism as taught by the historical Buddha, who lived 2,500 years ago approximately. And as he said, and I'm going to emphasize, don't take anything I say for granted. It's all to be examined and tested against your own experience and see what is valid for you and keep that. And if something's not valid or doesn't make sense or doesn't seem relevant to you, set it aside. Don't necessarily poo-poo it, but just say, okay, I'm not going to deal with that. And that's a perfectly acceptable way to approach Buddhism. It's not that you have to accept everything at one fell swoop. So we're talking about the mind and its potential. So first, as I mentioned last week, there are three major characteristics of the mind as described by the Buddha. And if you get nothing else out of this module, at least remember what these three are, and they'll come in very helpful, I think, in your future studies of Buddhism. The first is that the mind is non-physical. It is the non-physical aspect of our being. And as I mentioned earlier, we're going to use the words mind, consciousness, awareness as basically interchangeable. They don't mean quite the same thing, but I'm going to be kind of sloppy and jump around among those three terms. What I'm not talking about is the brain, okay? The brain is part of the physical aspect of our being, as is the entire nervous system, the nerves and the synapses and the neurons and everything like that. Brain and nervous system are physical. They're part of our body. The Buddha said, if you want to be real bare bones about it, all we are is a body and a mind that come together temporarily for generally 84.6 years or something like that, different in different cases, and then separate, okay? And that's all that we are as human beings, a body, every physical aspect of ourself, and a mind, the non-physical aspect of ourselves that come together temporarily. They are both continually changing. The physical body is changing, and the mind, the non-physical aspect, is also continually changing. And that is what we refer to in Buddhism, and you'll hear this word a lot, as impermanence. Impermanence means something, means that things are always changing. Okay, so as we'll talk a little bit, even though the mind is without beginning and without end, it always exists, it's always changing. So we say that it is impermanent in that aspect. It's not the same from any one fraction of a second to the next. It's impermanent. So the body comes from the sperm and the egg of the mother and father joining in the womb. The body matures, ages, then falls apart. It's impermanent. It's changing the whole time. Okay, the mind, the non-physical aspect, joins with the egg and sperm in the womb, stays connected with that body throughout the lifespan, and then at the moment of death, the body decays and the mind continues on. Okay? So the mind is our non-physical aspect of our being. And that means thoughts, memories, ideas, emotions, feelings. In the Buddhist view of the mind, we really don't divide things into thoughts and emotions. They are all things that are occurring within our mind. They are all non-physical experiences that we have. So just a very cold fact, like 2 + 2 = 4, and I love you more than any person in my entire life. Those are both mental experiences, different in quality. This is what we call the mental factors. They have all their different qualities associated with them, but in their basic nature, they're similar. They're non-physical mental experiences. So all of that that we're so familiar with is the non-physical aspect of our being, and that's the mind. And it's something we experience continuously. It's something we experience so often, it's sometimes hard to see that there is this non-physical aspect of the being. So according to the Buddha, that's all we are. We're the physical body and the non-physical mind that have come together temporarily and has the label in this lifetime of Robbie or Linda or Julie placed on it. Nothing more than that. According to the Buddhist view, there is no soul. Okay, there is no permanent, deep, unchanging aspect of Ravi that exists as a soul. There's just a mind and a body that have come together temporarily and then will inevitably separate. Okay, the body to decay, the mind continue on. So the first thing we need to be clear on is that we're talking about the non-physical aspect of our being. Okay, and all that that involves, feelings, emotions, and everything. So let's just take a minute, not go into formal meditation, but just think for a moment to ourselves, what does that mean? The mind is non-physical. It's the non-physical aspect of my being. What are the implications of that? Do I accept that or do I reject it? Just think about that for a moment. On one hand, it's kind of intuitively obvious, but we don't really think about it. The mind and the body are connected and interact, but the mind is the non-physical aspect. So a big implication of this is that the mind is not governed by the laws of physicality. Okay? And I think, you know, my body can be here, but my mind can be in Paris. Or my mind can be back on experience 10 years ago. or it could be on something that I did yesterday. Okay? The mind is not bound by the laws of physics that do govern our body. And this is why it's said that when we become enlightened, when we completely free up our mind or consciousness as a Buddha can pervade all existence. And it says that the minds, the consciousnesses of those in the past who have become Buddhas are around us continuously. Okay. We're not aware of it because our mind is very limited and very kind of crude in the way that it thinks. Okay. But it said the consciousness is not limited by the laws of ordinary physical existence. So that's kind of mind blowing to think about that. Okay. So
Robbie, yes. We do have a question if you want to pause.
Yeah, we'll take, okay. So that's all I have to say about that. Now let's see what the question
is. It relates to what you're talking about. Willis wants to know, so we are an experience?
I don't know if I'd use the word experience. Our mind is a series of experiences. Okay, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, nonstop series of mental events. We are just a temporary union of a body and mind, okay? Just a temporary phenomena, if you want to call that an experience, okay? But we're just a mind and body that have come together for a certain amount of time, and that's all we are. There is nothing more to our existence than our mind and our body, a physical side and a non-physical side. So I think the Buddhist terms we'd use would be a temporary phenomena or something that exists for a period of time, comes into existence and goes out of existence. Okay. Robbie's mind will, the consciousness will continue, but Robbie, which is this body and this mind, is just something that exists for a finite period of time. Okay? Okay. So that's the first aspect of mind characteristic. The mind obviously is very dependent on the nervous system, but it is not the nervous system. Consciousness or awareness is not something that we can find when we dissect the brain or the nervous system. There are certain certain phenomena, certain neurotransmitters and such that are very closely connected to it, but they are not the same thing. And this is kind of cutting edge in neuroscience right now, that they're starting to look at what this phenomena of consciousness or awareness is from a Western point of view. Okay, the second characteristic of mind is that it is without beginning and without end. Okay, this stream of, it's like thinking of a river maybe, or we refer to the stream of consciousness. It's very easy to see that, you know, what I'm thinking now is preceded by a previous moment of thought, by a previous moment of thought, by a previous moment of thought, by a period of sleeping last night, but there was still consciousness there, by moments of thought yesterday, last month, last year, last decade. We can trace our mind all the way back to when we were small children, and then there's some point where we can't remember what came before, but we know intuitively that there was consciousness there. And according to the Buddha, this consciousness was in the uterus, in the womb, in the embryo when it was in the womb. And this consciousness was preceded by previous moments of consciousness before that embryo was created, okay? Consciousness is a non-physical phenomena. So according to the Buddha, it can't come from physical causes. An egg and a sperm, which are both physical coming together, can't cause or can't create a non-physical phenomena. The non-physical brain or consciousness, excuse me, the physical brain, the non-physical consciousness always comes from a previous moment of consciousness. So this implies that there were previous rebirths where this consciousness was united with different bodies countless times before. And we can trace back and back, and we can never find the beginning. There is no beginning to my consciousness, or this consciousness that's united to my body. See, I'm referring to my consciousness and my body, and that's really an error. But we're so into that thinking of my body and my mind when they're just a temporary union. So this consciousness that I'm experiencing now, when I die, my body decays, the consciousness separates from the body, and that's the actual moment of death, according to the Buddhists, the separation of consciousness and body. The body decays, as we all know. The consciousness continues and associates with different bodies and future rebirths, again, without end. Now, those rebirths in the future are largely under the effect of our karma, the actions of body of positive and negative energy that we've created. But as we approach a state of enlightenment, those rebirths become more intentional. But right now, we're just being flung from lifetime to lifetime, or the consciousness is. Okay, so there was no beginning and no end. Okay. The implication here also is that this is not a universal sort of consciousness, one big soup of consciousness. Each stream is separate. Okay. Countless rebirths, but separate from other consciousnesses. So one can assume that there are no new consciousnesses being created, and none are going out of existence. Now, we talk about, in this lifetime, we talk about periods of unconsciousness. We talk about sleeping. But the Buddhist point of view is that our non-physical mind is always present, though it's functioning at different levels. And I'll touch on this briefly. We'll talk about this more. It's said that there are three levels of consciousness. There's the gross consciousness, which is the one we use in our waking lives. It goes around, goes through life, gets dressed, drives to work, makes decisions. And basically, once we study Buddhism, we realize that it's operating at a pretty crude level. It's really not seeing things the way they are, but it gets us through our daily life. Then there is the subtle consciousness, and it's said that we experience that consciousness we're aware of that consciousness when we're dreaming. Okay, it's said it's there at the time of sexual orgasm, various other experiences, but it's a deeper level of consciousness that has a more accurate view of things. And then there's the third level is called our most subtle, or our very subtle consciousness. And this is the one that actually continues from lifetime to lifetime. You know, it's not our personality. It's not our likes and dislikes, but it's the consciousness that carries all our karmic imprints, the imprints of all the positive and negative actions that we've done that will determine our future rebirths. So at the moment of death, and this is discussed in the module on death and dying, the gross consciousness and the very subtle consciousness are shed, or the gross consciousness and the subtle consciousness are shed, and it's the very subtle consciousness, sometimes what's referred to as the white light consciousness, that continues from one rebirth to the next, and it's that consciousness that creates the causes to become enlightened eventually. Okay, so there are different levels, always without beginning, always without end. We'll just see an infinite number of mental phenomena, thoughts, emotions, feelings, planning, likes, dislikes, all of these thoughts, one after another, okay? It's just like a continually flowing river without beginning and without end. Okay, all these thoughts. You can't find a moment where it starts. You can't find a moment where it ends.
Probably.
Let's just do a contemplation, then I'll get to it. Okay. So again, let's just take a moment and sit quietly. We're thinking about our mind, our awareness. It is without beginning. It is without end. What does that mean? Does that make sense to me? Okay. Let's see, what do we have in the chat, Linda?
So we do have a question about when does consciousness begin? Naga wants to know, does it begin at the cellular division in the embryo?
It does not begin, okay? There's no beginning. That's hard to wrap our mind around, okay? This is a phenomena without beginning. You cannot find the first moment of consciousness, because there is always a previous moment of consciousness. There is no beginning. Okay, now what we label as Robbie begins when the consciousness joins the union of the egg and sperm, which is two cells coming together. And the consciousness joins with that. So that's the beginning of what we conventionally label, and this is kind of Buddhist jargon, as Robbie begins. But that consciousness is without any beginning. You cannot find a beginning, according to the Buddha. Does that answer, is that the answer to the question? Maybe if Naga can turn her mic on, let me,
Yes, it does.
Okay.
I'm wondering if there are two cells joining, then are there two conscious joining?
The consciousness doesn't come from the cells, okay? That's just our physical body. The consciousness is on its own path, okay? So the cells do not create the consciousness, okay?
Thank you. Well,
one more question, Robbie.
Yeah.
Someone's son has an amazing aptitude for music, and she wants to know, could it be that he carried that over from another life?
That would very much be the Buddhist interpretation of that. Certain strong characteristics that we have in this lifetime are imprints carried from previous lifetimes. Now, most of the stuff like I like chocolate cake or, you know, this or that is shed at the time of death. The consciousness doesn't carry that, but certain strong imprints, like, you know, how did Mozart become Mozart at the age of four? Or, you know, we know certain children who are extremely kind just from the early age. And there are other children who are extremely cruel from very early on. That's not our parents. This is Venerable Rabin that talks about this a lot. We're not getting that from our parents. Okay. We are getting that from a previous from our own consciousness. Those are not genetic qualities that have been passed on to us. Kindness or cruelty or things like that. Those are imprints that were placed on our consciousness previously. We have to own it all. Our good qualities and our bad qualities. We can't blame our parents. Okay. Okay, so the third characteristic of our mind is that its essential nature is clear. And what does that mean? And this is where working with analogy, which the Buddha frequently used, is helpful, because we're talking, these are things that are hard to talk about sometimes. This is where we think of the mind as being like a perfectly clear sky. Okay, it has a perfectly empty sky. And our thoughts can be compared to clouds that pass through that sky. They come in over here, they pass through, and they exit over there. Okay? The clouds are not the sky. The sky is the space, the perfectly clear, empty space in which those thoughts occur. Okay, so our mind or consciousness is ultimately pure, clear, stainless. Now, for most of us, that's not our experience. Most of us will characterize ourselves as saying, I am an angry person, or I am a depressed person, or I am a kind person. And the Buddha saying, that's really not the accurate way of saying it. What you should be saying is, I am a person who frequently has angry thoughts. There are frequent angry thoughts occurring in my mind. There are frequent kind thoughts occurring in my mind. There are frequent resentful or jealous thoughts occurring in my mind. And the Buddha said, if you want to be, all you have to do to be happy is get rid of those thoughts that cause you problems, the anger, the resentment, the attachment, and replace them with thoughts of kindness, generosity, patience. But most of us have developed habitual ways of thinking, so that certain types of thoughts occur over and over. And we've gotten very good at those thoughts, and we've developed stories to go with them and justify them. And we say, that's who I am. That's what I'm stuck with. And this is where Buddhism is really quite optimistic. You're not stuck with any of that, because none of that is permanently part of your mind. Those are just thoughts that are occurring within the space of your mind. And as Venerable Rabina says, Buddhism is just about developing new habits of mind. Get rid of the thoughts that don't work for you. Cultivate and develop the thoughts that do work for you. Have more happy, generous, loving thoughts. Have fewer angry, depressed, resentful thoughts. And that sounds incredibly superficial, like Norman Vincent Peale and the power of positive thinking. But it's not just get rid of the bad, because most of the negative thoughts are the result of our past karma, okay? Things we've done in the past. So we have to deal with our karma. But it is possible through the techniques that the Buddha taught that we can diminish the number of thoughts that cause problems, and we can cultivate the thoughts that cause happiness. And this is what becoming enlightened is all about, changing the nature of the thoughts that arise and go away in the space that is our mind. Okay, so the Buddha is just having nonstop thoughts one after another, compassion, wisdom, compassion, wisdom. That's all that occurs in the mind of a Buddha. Angry thoughts never arise because he's eliminated the cause of them completely. Resentment never arises. Jealousy. He or she has just created the causes to experience nothing but compassion and wisdom in all their manifestations. So the mind of a Buddha, again, has no fixed characteristics. It is just the space, or we can think of it as the potential, the space in which those thoughts occur. And we're having, I forget the number, just countless thoughts, mental experiences within the flick of a finger. I think it's 186,000 or something like that. And we begin, when we start to meditate, we become aware of just these nonstop mental phenomena. And it's pretty uncontrolled. And people get depressed by that initially, but just becoming aware of that is very positive. And so then we can start to exercise some cultivation of the positive qualities and some elimination of the negative qualities. So the mind itself is clear, is pure. That's its nature. These characteristics that we think make up ourselves, they're just temporary phenomena occurring within that empty space. And we can fill that space with whatever kind of thoughts we want to. Okay, so let's just take a minute for contemplation. And think of our mind as a vast empty space filled with perfectly clear light. And we think of the thoughts as just temporary phenomena occurring in that space, one after another. We can just look at the thoughts without getting attached, with the understanding that they come and go within the space that is our mind. Okay, I think we've got some questions or comments, if you can.
We do.
Okay.
So the first one was, if we've gone from 3 billion to 7 billion in population, how can there be no new consciousnesses?
Yeah, okay. That's good. Our consciousness does not always pick a human body, okay? It can be an insect body. I think the number of insects is increasing also. It can be a rebirth, if you want to call it that, that is in other realms that we don't perceive, okay? It's said that there are six realms. That's taught in a later class, but we're moving continually in and out of different realms. So the number of consciousnesses in any one realm at any time may change, but the total number of consciousnesses remain finite. Okay, definitely more consciousnesses are uniting with human bodies during our lifespan, which means that those consciousnesses are coming out of other realms. But no new consciousnesses are being created. But that's based on an acceptance of other realms, which is not something you really need to grapple with now.
Okay. And to piggyback that, John had answered that question saying, considering how many billions of ants, fish, animals, etc. there are, not all of our rebirths are precious human rebirths.
Exactly.
And so yeah. Then someone else asked, David asked, I'm not sure that a human rebirth is any more precious than any other sentient being, with a question mark.
Okay. That's not really the subject of this class, but I'll touch on that. There are certain realms, certain rebirths that are considered to be more pleasurable than the human rebirth. There are certain realms that are considered to be more suffering in general, okay, if you take the mean. It's said that the advantage of a human rebirth is that it's just the right mixture of pleasurable experiences and of suffering experiences to motivate us to study and develop our minds. In the more pleasurable realms, more pleasurable rebirths, you're just blissed out and you have no motivation to get off your butt. In the more suffering rebirths, you're obsessed with your suffering and you don't have the freedom to develop your mind. So it said it's kind of like Goldilocks, human realm, not too hot, not too cold. But if we take advantage, actually the most favorable one to develop our mind, okay, which doesn't mean we're going to do it. And certainly different human, some human rebirths are more, make it easier to do that than others. You know, we could be born, in a country where there were no teachings. We could be born with a defective mind or defective body that makes it more difficult to study. But in general, the human rebirth is considered the result of good karma, and it gives us the opportunity to develop our minds if we take advantage of it. But the consciousness in the merest, smallest little ant is completely, has as much potential to become enlightened, even in this lifetime, as the greatest human scholar of Buddhism. Their potential is the same, okay, to become completely enlightened. Now, it's a lot harder if you're in an ant's body, but we've all been reborn in every possible realm and body countless times in the past. You know, we don't stay in the human realm. Okay, wandering off, yeah.
And we do have some more questions, Robbie, if you want to tackle
them. Yeah, let's go through all the questions.
Sure. Someone from watching on YouTube wants to know, let's see here. Let me make sure I'm reading it correctly. If everything is temporary, including our mind stream and Buddha's, how should the temporary nature of Buddha's mind be analyzed in samsaric context? How can you rely on enlightened but changing mind?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, okay, let's talk in terms of impermanent and permanent. There are actually a very few things that are permanent. One of which is empty space, completely empty space, and that it is not changing. Another permanent phenomena is the what's referred to as the cessation of a negative mind state. So if we develop our mind to the point that we no longer experience emptiness or anger, so that anger never arises in our mind stream ever, that's said to be permanent, in that it's not changing. Okay, so in the mind of a Buddha, the elimination of all negative qualities is permanent. What is changing is the nature of their compassion and their wisdom based on the needs of others. Okay, so it's not unchanging. It's always there, but it's changing. So that's how we would say that the mind of a Buddha is impermanent, in that it's changing. The removal of the negative qualities is permanent, okay? A lot of Buddhist jargon there, but I think that is maybe something about what you're asking. Okay, we can depend on a Buddha always being motivated by compassion and wisdom. So those are changing within the mind stream of a Buddha. I could just say, you know, this is always the cop-out. I could say, oh, that's a good question for a geshe. That's what we say when we don't know how to answer something, but that would be my understanding of it. Okay?
And along those same lines, we have a couple more that Loretta wants to know, if thoughts are temporary, mm-hmm. what about feelings such as love?
Is feeling? Love, yeah. Yeah.
One more part to that question. Is love considered pure? And having no beginning and no end.
Yeah. Love is not pure. It's not without beginning and no end. It's just a temporary phenomena. And what we look as permanent is just a series of loving thoughts occurring one after another or very frequently. So it's changing, but it's going to come into existence and it's going to go out of existence. It's not lasting. And it's certainly, for most of us, love is mixed in with other thoughts. I mean, we are having so many microscopic slivers of thoughts that we're not even aware of. You know, it seems like all we're thinking is, oh, love, 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 I love her so much. Oh, that's all I'm thinking. There's a lot of other thoughts going on in there. Okay. So it's a mix. It's a real stew when we start to look at our minds. Yeah.
And along those same lines, Willis says, so our mind is like a blank movie screen.
Yes, that's a good image.
The movie, and he continues with, the movies that are projected as our thoughts, feelings, emotions, etc. So to be a Buddha would have a blank movie screen, or be able to choose the movie.
Yeah, ability to choose the movie. Yeah, right now we're stuck there watching this movie based on our past actions of body, speech, and mind. And, you know, we may say, this movie really stinks. I'd like to watch another one. So it's our responsibility to create the causes to see another movie. The mind of a Buddha is not a blank, okay? It's filled nonstop with thoughts of compassion and wisdom. Okay, that's what's being projected on the screen of a Buddha's mind. But I think that's a very good image. The blank screen is our mind. Right now, we don't have much choice about what's being projected on it. But as we develop our mind, we can develop more control over it and cultivate the quality so that we're watching a movie that's all compassion, all wisdom, all the time. Yeah, that's a great analogy also.
So that's a great segue to the next one, if you want to keep going.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So how would you explain karmic imprints on a clear mind?
Okay, that is really a question for a Geshe, okay? The karmic imprints are, the term is bokchaks, and they are carried on various energy winds. And I am not going to go into that anymore. That is a really complicated area. That's a great question. Just accept that there are explanations for it, but I'm not qualified to give them. Yeah, that's in an area of teachings called the Abhidharma, and it's the relationship between karma and consciousness.
So the next question.
Right now, just think that the imprints are carried on the consciousness. The imprints are non-physical. The consciousness is non-physical. But it's hard to visualize it without it being physical, and I can't really get into that.
And then to segue to the next question, amazing how these all line up. Helen wants to know, are the mind and consciousness the same? Is consciousness the very subtle mind, or subtle mind, or gross mind?
I'm using mind and consciousness as the same, okay? We can say there are different levels of mind, different levels of consciousness. I don't think you can come up with a distinction between mind and consciousness the way we're talking about them here. But just think about it as that it's that non-physical aspect of our being, whatever term you want to use. Of course, we're trying to translate the teachings of the Buddha into English, and sometimes it doesn't go that well, or there are different ways of translating it. But I'm using mind and consciousness with various levels within those, either of those, is pretty much the same.
And we have one more, Robbie. Kelly wants to know, is it easier to develop your mind where your environment is full of challenging people, so you have to practice patience, etc., more, or in an environment full of role models?
Yeah. Great question. I think it depends, yeah. It's whatever works for you, okay? And probably at different times in your spiritual studies, different types of environment will work. There's this teaching that we should see everyone as a Buddha. The most irritating people are Buddhas who are there to teach us something. And even if it's not true, it can be effective. I don't think it's definitely one or the other. I think it depends on you and where you are on your spiritual path. Yeah. Great question, though. Okay. Thank you. So let's wind things up. Like I say, I like to keep these to about an hour. I think that's a good Zoom length. So let's just sit for a moment, reflect, do what we call a review meditation on the three points that we talked about tonight. Mind is non-physical. Mind is without beginning and without end, and its nature is clear. So just have those in your mind, and you can do a brief dedication. Acknowledge that we've created some positive energy by coming together tonight, and may that make an imprint on our consciousness, however that happens, that will ripen in the future. Okay, so what I would like people to do this week is sit in meditation for 6 days out of the week, and each session do 5 minutes of breathing meditation, and then 5 minutes of what we call analytic meditation, where you use that focused, concentrated mind to work with one of the three aspects of the mind. Just, what does this mean? Do I agree with this or disagree? Is this my experience? And just kind of play with those, and we'll come back together next week and we'll talk about what the function of the mind is and how it relates with the world around us. And thank you for all the questions. Those were really good questions. I always enjoy those. Anything else, Linda?
Let me see here. Loretta says, Robbie defined love as more of the romantic love, and my definition of love is a pure, empty faith.
Okay. The Buddhist definition of love is the wish that others be happy, okay? Compassion is the wish that they be free of suffering. And Buddhist love is the wish that others be happy. And, you know, it doesn't have any of me, and it doesn't mean wish they be happy with me. So that is pure. I'm just saying, in our mind stream right now, for most of us, what we label as love is mixed up with a lot of other thoughts, okay? Now, the love of a Buddha is pure and uncontaminated, but most of us aren't there yet. Okay, anything else?
That's it.
Okay, that was good.
The question from YouTube, they thanked you for that explanation.
The non-explanation, okay. Well, thank you.
And I just wanted to share a happy little... A little being here.
Who's that?
This is Mavis. Mavis joined our family right at Christmas, and she slept the whole class until about 1 minute ago.
Okay.
So good job, Mavis.
Great. Okay, so everybody stay healthy, and we will get together again in a week's time.
Hi, everyone. Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Robbie.
Thanks, Robbie.
Yeah.
Thanks, Linda.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good night, everyone.
Thanks.
Thanks all.
Good night.